gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside. Oh, down by the riverside.
Yeah.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna study.
From WNYC's The Green Space, it's a special edition of The Brian Lehrer Show, the finale of our End of War series. Listeners, you can watch today's program as well as hear it. See the live streaming video on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And to those of you who have come in partway during this series on the air, or those of you who've gathered here in The Green Space for this finale, a little background. We first got this idea when President Obama announced that all U.S. troops would be out of Iraq by the end of last year. Our senior producer, Megan Ryan, asked, why not think big and use the opportunity to explore the idea of whether humanity can abolish war altogether? Then we saw the new book, The End of War, by John Horgan, who actually argues that, yes, humanity could do this. John will be on with us here on the stage later in the program. So I'm curious to ask our Green Space audience, how many of you, just with a show of hands, think it's possible for people to stop fighting wars? Be honest. Yes and no are both acceptable answers. Could humanity abolish war? Who would say no? Looks like about, well, I won't say until I ask the other question. Who would say yes? All right, so the no's have it, but only by a little, which makes this a relatively optimistic crowd, because generally, as John Horgan writes in his book, about 80% of people say, no, humanity cannot abolish war to that question. We won't, of course, answer the question today definitively, but we will ask, if humanity is to try to end war someday, how could it be done? What would it take? We have many people to help think this through, including John Horgan later, Congressman Dennis Kucinich later, who has proposed a bill to create a Department of Peace. He introduces it in session after session, and much more. But audience, let's work on this. How many of you think that to end war, most countries on Earth would need to be democracies? A fair amount of support for democracy as a prerequisite. How many of you think women would need to have at least half the power in government decisions about whether to go to war? The audio response tells you at home that women are popular as a prerequisite. How many of you think war won't end until it's not as profitable as it is today? And as usual, in our crowds, the profit motive kind of carries the day in terms of the biggest thing that people think is an obstacle to ending war. How many of you think we will have war as long as we have religion? Not that many. And how many of you think we'll always have war until the gap between rich and poor is substantially reduced? And fewer even than who think religion needs to be gone. Well, guess what? John Horgan doesn't agree with any of you. And we'll hear that later. He thinks those commonly cited obstacles are not the keys to ending war, and we'll hear why later. But right now we'll meet a few other special guests, veterans and refugees who have lived through wars as fighters and victims and sometimes heroes, just as human beings. They are gathered together here in the green space. Tariq is here. He just arrived from Iraq last month as a refugee after serving as a translator for the U.S. military and others. Tariq, we're honored to have you here. Andrew Roberts is here, director of Veterans Liaison Services at North Shore LIJ Hospital. He fought in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. Welcome. Syed Suwalic is here, a refugee from the Bosnian War, now a program officer for the International Rescue Committee. He was a corporate lawyer who took up arms because he thought it was necessary. And Carl Callender, a U.S. Marine Reserve veteran, served in Kuwait in Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, now with Black Veterans for Social Justice here in New York. Syed, maybe I'll start with you. Where are you? Hi. What do you think the deepest root causes were of the war that you have been through? Greed, envy, fear of scarcity, ethnic hatred, as deep as you can go, why did you and your country deal with its problems in the worst possible way, a war?
Thank you for that question. I think that war, all those series of wars in the Balkans, they were actually, they had three elements. One was religion, one was East and West kind of meet at the Balkans, and there was definitely some civil war elements in all that. But doesn't matter which element we take, this was horrible, and I think it could have been avoided because it was in Europe, and we just heard about United Europe now, and at that time I was hoping actually that that war wouldn't really start, and when it started, I thought that it will last for a maximum 6 months, and I was wrong in both of these issues.
So looking back, is there anything that may have prevented it at the deepest level that we can learn from for the future?
Absolutely. I think that more diplomacy could have prevented this at the very beginning, because I think that there was some wrong messages and miscommunication between European countries at that time. And I think that until the U.S. stepped in, there was no really any positive things happening. And, of course, we saw everything later, but it was 3 or 4 years later.
So we stepped in with a military solution to a military problem.
Well, that was the only solution at that time, because I also think that as soon as you react on something like this, you can succeed with less resources or power that you need. But the more you wait, the harder it will be.
Tariq, where are you? Can I ask you the same question with respect to Iraq? We're just out of that war in terms of the U.S. Obviously, there are still fighting that goes on there among Iraqis. What do you think the deepest root causes were of this war that we have been through?
Good morning, and thank you for your question. First of all, war, what had happened in Iraq, should take place and must happen at that time, you know, because we were suffering at that time. And only the people who were living there knows what's the meaning of living, you know, in like, you know, a dictator regime, and we don't have any democracy, we don't have anything. So it should take place and should what happened and happened that time. But, you know, we thought that when war starts, we thought that everything's going to be okay, and we're going to live, you know, in a different way, the way it's going to be better. But the thing that it's become worse, you know, because at that time, so many things happened, like civil war between two, you know, religions, and people started to being killed, and we had, you know, so many suffering at that time.
So when we ask these deep questions today, and maybe the way I was posing them earlier is too abstract for somebody like you who's just been through a long war in your home country, mm-hmm. and just arrived in the United States. But when we talk about fear of scarcity, ethnic hatred, envy, gender inequality, religion, you know, we can sit here and say, well, the U.S. shouldn't have invaded, or we can sit here and say, well, it was Saddam Hussein's brutality, or it was the British that carved up Iraq in the early 20th century. Do you think there are deep root causes of the war in Iraq that even transcend those specifics, that imply an answer as to how humanity can end war?
Yes, absolutely. There is just such a thing like that. For my opinion, to end, you know, war in my country or in other countries, It's in a simple sense, as I can put it. We should know like how to love our children and grandchildren so we can prevent war not happening. This is for my opinion.
So Andrew Roberts, Director of Veterans Liaison Services at North Shore LIJ. You fought in Iraq in 2003 and 2004. You saw his war from another side.
That's right.
And did you wind up thinking about some of the same questions in terms of abolishing war? I was very struck by Tariq just now coming to the personal, to the family, rather than some kind of geopolitical answer.
Right. Well, I think that no one hates war more than those that have actually been involved in one. I personally was impacted by my experiences, having a sense of isolation when I got back, having a high startle response, still sort of feeling like I'm on patrol. I was at times depressed, and it was 3 years after I got home before I connected any of those emotions with what I had experienced. So I know firsthand the impact of the individual. I know that it's a normal, now I know that it's a normal response to serving. But I think one of the things that has made it easier for our country to be led into war is the divide between the military and the civilian population. Less than 1% of Americans have served in the military at this point. And although I think it's something like 84% of people that have served in Iraq and Afghanistan feel like the civilian population doesn't understand what they've been through. And 70%, this is from the Pew Research study last year, but 70% of Americans sort of say that all these sacrifices and these emotions and, you know, experiences of the soldier are just, that's just part of the job for people that have served.
And so there's a disconnect in our society in particular from the horrors of war and most Americans' personal lives. This gets into an uncomfortable policy question, but do you think it would actually help serve to abolish war, as I think Congressman Charles Rangel and others have implied with some of their proposals, that if we had a draft, there would be more revulsion to sending people to war? It would be harder for policymakers whose own kids probably aren't going to go.
I can't say that I haven't thought about that on more than one occasion. You know, I've seen college students protesting tuition rates, and I sort of laugh, you know, because it's money. You know, that's what they're worried about, their pocketbook to an extent, and that's what gets them rallied enough and excited enough to get out there and really protest. And you know, we're talking about 230,000 Americans with traumatic brain injury. You know, we're talking about 37% of people that have served that might have PTSD at this point.
And so, even the GI Bill, which is extremely popular because it gives people rewards they richly deserve, in a way serves as an economic draft for a small group.
You know, there's no question that a lot of the, I mean, they always say that the U.S. military is a slice of the American population. So I spent 7 years in the Army. I spent 4 years prior to that at West Point, and I met all walks of life. But there's no question that the military is a tough option, but for some that have a tougher background, that it can be a great option. You know,
And Carl Callender, you've used or are using, I understand, the GI Bill. You're a U.S. Marine Reserve veteran. You served in Kuwait in Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. Now you're with Black Veterans for Social Justice here in New York. Do you want to pick up on this idea that the more that the cost of war is concentrated in a small segment of society, the harder it is to abolish war?
Well, my perspective on that is more or less when you have people, a select group of people with a large amount of power, what's going to happen is they're going to impose their will more or less whenever they need to do so or see fit. At the time where I was sent to Iraq, or Kuwait City for that matter, I didn't have very many questions being a service member in the Marine Corps. You're most effective, I guess, when you're not questioning your general orders and things of that nature and just following through with the theme of mission accomplishment. But when I returned, more or less, that's when I began to question exactly why I was over there and was the mission, the most moral type of mission to undertake for the U.S. government. I guess my perspective at this point in time would definitely be that it's we were happy to be able to assist the Iraqi people with implementing a democratic government. However, I think the outcome of whether it was a successful war is going to take a long period of time for us to decide whether that's a complete success.
Do you two, as U.S. vets, think that humanity can ever abolish war? Have you ever stopped to think about it, Carl, on that level?
I actually think the only way that that could ever happen would be some type of global form of government. As long as you have independent nations, you're always going to have one nation either coveting whatever the other nation has or possibly believing that they're misappropriating the resources and they can be better managed by a more powerful system.
Andrew, same question.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time personally thinking about war, about, you know, the justification of it. But having been raised, I mean, since I was 18 years old in a military environment, we always knew we would have debates as cadets at West Point about different wars and should we have gone and what was, you know, having discussions about them. And we were trained to understand it was okay to have these discussions behind closed doors as long as at the end of the day you realize that there's a point when the leadership is going to give you a lawful order to go to war and you're going to have to execute.
On the phone with us right now is one of the people who posted an end-of-war comment on the site of the newspaper Guardian U.S., which was good enough to spread our project to additional communities, Alistair Malarney, an Irish immigrant living in San Diego. Alistair, hello from New York. Thank you for joining us on the phone.
We always knew we would have
debates. Alistair, can you hear me?
All
right, let's see if we can get Alistair Malarney up on the phone. Alistair, what led you to answer our question, can humanity abolish war?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Alistair. I think you got me now, right? Okay, unfortunately we're not. Okay, one more shot. Alistair, are you there? All right. So, how about... how about going back to our Bosnian refugee, Sayad Sulić? Do you think humanity can ever abolish war?
Yes, I think that's possible. And I think that more and more people actually now learn about all these horrible wars, and more people can take active role in stepping up and helping that these wars don't happen anymore.
Tariq, why doesn't that happen more in Iraq? Or maybe you're going to tell me that it is happening. After all the horrible violence of the recent years, it seems like there is still some appetite for taking up arms to solve the remaining conflicts. Is it because the fear of scarcity, the fear of oppression, overwhelms the hope of peace?
The fear of oppression that there, you know, because in Iraq, when war happens, we thought that we have a democracy government, but it is not like that. You know, they only do what another side tell them to do, another government telling them to do. So I don't want to mention which country, you know. So who is the victim in this side? The people are victims. And if we want to, as I said, to end the war, we should know how to love our children and grandchildren. But in my opinion, we cannot end war because, you know, it's all about democracy and governments and the leaders. It's all by their hands.
We will continue with all these guests and add John Horgan, author of The End of War, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and others. Coming up, Brian Lehrer on WNYC in the Green Space with the finale of our series, End of War.
Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, gonna lay down my hymn book, down by...
Gonna lay down my... my sword and shield, down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Gonna lay down my sword and shield, down by the riverside. Study war no more.
From WNYC's The Green Space, it's a special edition of The Brian Lehrer Show, the finale of our series, End of War. Listeners, you can watch today's program as well as hear it. See the live streaming video on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Please welcome science writer John Horgan, who helped inspire our series with his book, The End of War. And please welcome to talk about his longstanding proposal for a Department of Peace, Ohio Congressman and two-time Democratic presidential primary candidate, Dennis Kucinich. Thank you. John, we'll ask you to sit tight for a few minutes. Congressman, first, our underlying question. I don't know if you were here for much of the previous hour hearing people answer the question, but do you think humanity can ever abolish war?
Of course it can. And you know, the question doesn't relate to humanity in the abstract. It relates to each of us. What is really called for is an evolution of human consciousness. When we focus on war and believe that war is inevitable, war becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But instead of looking at war in the macrocosm, which is very easy to do, and it's very easy to take a stand for peace in the abstract, when we focus on our own lives and the conflicts that occur in our own lives and how we negotiate those conflicts and how we resolve them, we can find the key to being able to explore the science of human relations, in which we discover our own ability to be able to end the wars in our own life and then come to an understanding of how we can help eliminate wars on a larger scale.
That's a very personal starting point. How does practicing peace in our families in Brooklyn or Bergen County or in Cleveland prevent war in Rwanda or Bosnia or Iraq?
Well, war in the microcosm is domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse, violence in the schools, gang violence, gun violence, racial violence, violence against gays. Our society is sated with war. And so it starts with individuals. It starts with our perception of violence and learning. You know, I think that nonviolence, felicity, can actually be taught. Violence is a learned response, no question about it. Nonviolence can be taught, which is why the Department of Peace proposal really seeks to create a structure in the society so we begin to exercise our capabilities to practice resolution of very human-type conflicts that come every day in a way that doesn't hurt people. And that requires, Brian, that we a shift in our thinking that we're not just our brother's keeper, we are an aspect of our brother, that a conception that says that we are all interconnected and interdependent, that it's not just the I and thou, but it's the I in an expanded sense, that we're all part of each other, that's that connection that enables us to see the imperative of human unity.
A spiritual connection to a common humanity.
It's not just spiritual, Brian. It's a fact. I mean, you look at the human genome theory. Science will say they're all made of the same stuff. So if that's true, if there's a scientific basis for human unity, if there's a technological basis for human unity with the internet, with air transit, with cellular technology, being able to call somebody on a phone right now and get them a split second later anywhere in the world, if we have that, then what is stopping ourselves, from whom all of these inventions flow, what stops us from being able to make the connection to each other in a way that just says, look, this violence is passé, it's archaic. So this really relates to individual responsibility, but also when you take that path, and you start to see how leaders or nations take a detour into war, then we have an obligation to challenge it. But what really gives it authenticity and the challenge and integrity is when we make the journey in our own lives. It's easy to stand for peace on earth, try, you know, taking that stand in a marriage, right?
So you've been proposing a Peace Department bill for many sessions of Congress in a row. I should say to our listeners who may think, oh, this is a Kucinich thing, I've read how it goes all the way back to one of the founding fathers, Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and wanted a Department of Peace with equal standing to the War Department in the early U.S. government.
Well, we do have connections to our founding fathers.
So tell us how this would work on a practical basis if Congress were ever to pass your bill.
If you look at the massive federal bureaucracy, and as soon as you say, well, I want to create a department, people go, oh, God, another, just what we need, another federal department. The so-called Department of Defense takes 50% of all discretionary spending. We're spending trillions of dollars in wars, and we don't spend a fraction of that in trying to create a peaceful society. So the idea of a Department of Peace, when I studied war in the 20th century, 100 million people perished in wars, most of them innocent civilian noncombatants. When you look at the, as John will talk about and he points out in his great book, this assumption that war is inevitable. No, it's not. We need to create structures in our society, just as we have a health and human services and environmental protection, all those things that some of our Republican friends want to dismantle. What we need to do is to create a structure so that we help to define a level of consciousness in our society where we are, as a society, working to create more peaceful homes, communities, and a nation. This is something that you make part of the everyday life of America. Now, that's not to say that it isn't already happening in many places, but to have an organized approach. I mean, right now, what we have is an organized approach towards violence, and it's a nightmare.
Some of the things in the bill that are like that already take place in our society. I see that provisions of the bill include conflict resolution and mediation, education in schools, anti-gang efforts, drug rehab, battered women's rights, very local things like that. What would really be new here?
Well, first of all, you have an organized approach and you fund it. There are so many organizations out there that are just struggling for help. There are so many people who've trained their lives in service to, you know, their community and in service to humanity. And at the same time, they have trouble finding funding for the work that they want to do. So, but we would make available to schools, all schools, curricula that would help to teach children peace-giving, peace-sharing, mutuality, looking at that other person as an aspect of oneself, and to do it in a way that can be joyful. We're not the main message of this legislation, which is now supported by 50 members of this Congress, and in the past we've had as many as 90 members of a previous Congress, is that we're not chained to this wheel of violence. That it's not only that war is not inevitable, but it is not inevitable that we descend into some circle of Dante's hell, that we do have the ability to evolve. And that is at the core of this. It's a belief in our capacity for evolution, in human evolution, the evolution of consciousness, the emergence of global citizenship, the perception and the acting upon the principle of human unity.
So John Horgan, science journalist, professor at Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey, you helped inspire this series with your recent book, The End of War. You were our first guest in the series. What do you think about what you've been hearing today in the finale so far?
First of all, I am so thrilled at this conversation that you've started. I said in the introduction of my book that I didn't necessarily expect people to become as optimistic as I am. What I wanted to do was to provoke a conversation to get people, if they're pessimists, and most people are. This is a very atypical audience here. Most people are very pessimistic. I wanted them to think about why they're pessimistic. Is it because you think war is part of human nature? We evolved to be natural warriors, which is what some scientists are saying, and that's wrong? Is it because you think that war is the inevitable consequence of too many people struggling for too few resources? That theory is also wrong. I just wanted people to really examine their own ideas and try to see if they stand up empirically, because I think, as Dennis just said, that pessimism itself prevents us from getting rid of the problem of war. To the extent that we think that we're intrinsically warlike, or the world is a warlike place and always will be, of course we're going to need a strong military to protect ourselves from these enemies that will always be out there. But just addressing what Dennis just said, I disagree with one possible implication of his vision of a future without violence at all scales. I look at war as a really weird, specific manifestation of some human traits, let's say aggression, that emerged very recently in human prehistory, only about 10,000 years ago, and then perpetuated itself from there. War can infect any type of society. This is what I've concluded after examining all the research on war. But any kind of society can also stop fighting if it has the collective will to do so. We've seen this in the cases of Sweden and Switzerland. Costa Rica is another wonderful example. I actually think that war can end very rapidly. We happen to be in a period, believe it or not, with very few war casualties over the last decade compared to pretty much any time in the 20th century. So war is declining for cultural reasons.
Even counting 100,000 in Iraq or whatever number you want to put on that?
Yes, right. So I think it's actually an impediment to thinking about world peace to attach it to something like peace at all scales. The end of, I don't know, war between the sexes. Conflict between parents and their children, economic competition, and these sorts of things, which I think actually are inevitable. I like to look at New York City as a demonstration proof of a society with all sorts of conflicts and disagreements and every possible type of person, rich and poor, people from all different ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds who argue all the time incessantly. You can hear it sometimes on Brian's show, but they don't carry out suicide bombings against each other. They don't kill each other in massive numbers. So the world that I see without war is actually a world very much like ours, except just without this parasitic meme of war and militarism.
But let me dig a little deeper on this, because you seem to reject, as I indicated to the audience earlier, the social prerequisites for ending war that tend to come up in these conversations. Democratization around the world, reducing greed, gender equality because testosterone fights. But you argue that war will end through cultural change. So maybe you should write a sequel to your book that really lays it out. But what do you think these cultural change pathways are if they're not those things?
Right. Well, so again, looking at scholarly analyses of war, there are virtually an infinite number of war theories. There are theories that connect war to religion, to racial or ethnic differences, to economic inequality, resource scarcity, to gender inequality. Pretty much anything that you can imagine, things that we've discussed today. There are scholars who say that's the explanation of war, and the implication is that if we just focus on this one thing, put more women in positions of power, then war will go away. I don't see it that way. I think what the research says is that war is this self-perpetuating thing. War is perpetuated by fear of war. I think we see that right now in the situation with Iran. It's not about resources or anything like that. We think that they're building a bomb that could threaten us and Israel, and so we're threatening them accordingly. So, and, and, And the wonderful thing is that if we can reduce militarism, the tremendous spending on our gigantic military machine, that, and this is a message for social activists out there, that might help you, it almost certainly will help you with environmental problems, with economic inequality. It will give you more money for spending on education and healthcare. So instead of creating a utopia that then, as a consequence, will have no war, you get rid of war, you focus on war and militarism, and as a consequence of that, all these other good things will happen.
Congressman, what are you thinking?
I think one of the reasons we're here today is because we're still in Iraq and Afghanistan. I stood with probably a million people on 1st and 2nd Avenue in March or February, I think it was, of 2003, just before we attacked Iraq. And there were a million people there. And so this was a war of choice. And this is something that we have to say here. We went to war against a nation that did not attack us based on choice. And what was behind that? You know, there was venality, there were lies, there's justice still that has to be created as a result of that decision. But a million innocent Iraqis died as a result. You don't hear that discussed too much. That is a significant number, and there are consequences for that. So this America needs to go through a period. If we are going to shed the shackles of war, we need to go through a period of truth and reconciliation about what happened that took us into war, and we need to understand that we're still choosing war. We chose to go to war in Iraq. We chose to go to war in Afghanistan. I think we had a right to strike at the training camps, but we chose to go there. We're choosing a war against Iran right now. We're playing with the flash of war at this very moment. These are choices that are made, and we have to ask ourselves, what is it about those who represent us that they feel that the only way that they can deal with conflict is to use the military? This is the limitation of thinking that hobbles us, not only in terms of those who are making decisions, but it hobbles mass consciousness today in terms of this idea that we're just locked onto glide paths towards war and the inevitability of war. And I say we have to keep challenging the thinking that takes us there. And your book does that, but we're in a specific time frame right now. And if you go through that, if you really go deep, and look, I spent the better part of the last 10 years every single day challenging these wars on every possible way that you can. And what I've learned is that people just don't understand in Washington that there's another way of resolving conflict without killing people. And this is the challenge that we have. So we have to go back to the streets. But when we go back to the streets, we also have to know about the violence that we may find in our own lives and try to deal with that as well so that we have a greater impact in our presence.
All right. We are going to take a short break. And when we continue here in the green space, we're going to spread this out from the United States back to other parts of the world. We're going to bring in some professional peacemakers from the Middle East and Africa. Congressman Kucinich will stay. John Horgan will stay. Our other guests will stay as we continue with the finale of our series, End of War, live in the green space on WNYC.
Down by the riverside, I'm gonna lay down on my burden. Down by the riverside, sturdy, one more.
It's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show in the green space, the finale of our series, End of War. Listeners, you can watch today's program as well as hear it. See the live streaming video on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Congressman Dennis Kucinich is still here. John Horgan, author of The End of War, is still here. Also with us now, two professional peacemakers, I think we might call them. They work to prevent war for a living. Manal Omar, director of Iraq, Iran, and North Africa programs for the U.S. Institute of Peace in their Center for Post-Conflict Peace and Stability Operations. That organization was created by Congress. She was previously Middle East Program Director for Oxfam and worked with Women for Women International in Sudan and elsewhere. And she joins us via phone from Washington. And here in the green space, Lena Slockmulder, Chief Programming Officer of the private not-for-profit group Search for Common Ground. Born in New York, she has lived and worked in Africa for 21 years as a human rights defender, journalist, performer, and more. Lena, Manal, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lena, tell us about your work with Search for Common Ground.
Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting us, and it's a really important conversation that we're having. So Search for Common Ground really is an organization that believes that we can address conflict collaboratively and not adversarially. So we don't think that conflict is not natural. Conflict is part of our lives. And what we do in 30 countries across the world is enable people to have the tools, have the skills, and have the confidence to be able to transform that conflict without violence. Land conflicts, ethnic conflicts, resource conflicts, gender conflicts. We are enabling people across Africa and across the world to be able to work together to recognize that in relationship, they're more secure and they're more safe moving towards peace than they would if they adopted violence.
Do you see the job as different in developing countries from the kind of Peace Department proposal Congressman Kucinich was describing for the United States, or other things in the context of this superpower?
I think there's certain challenges. I've worked, for example, the last 6 years in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has seen one of the century's worst wars. There's certainly issues where we need to raise people's awareness to ensure that they've got the same level of information so that they can engage equally as partners as they seek to transform a conflict. So sometimes we may need to have a more of a component around education, maybe enabling people to reduce their stereotypes and their prejudices to be able to enter a space of trust and confidence to transform that conflict. But I would say that even in the United States, we also need to do those types of things as well, to depolarize and to reduce stereotypes and prejudices.
Manal, let me go to you next. Tell us about your work with the U.S. Institute of Peace.
Great. Yeah, with the U.S. Institute of Peace, one of the primary issues, as my colleague was saying, is recognizing that conflict will always exist. The key is, how do you resolve conflict nonviolently? I think the most important aspect of our work is finding local partners on the ground. I always say that every culture, every country has the art of peace building. It has the art of conflict resolution. It's finding those natural stakeholders that are doing conflict resolution, working with them, adding a bit of the science, providing the tools, and providing safe space for them to be able to convene and address the issues of conflict.
Can you give me an example, Manal? Give us a success story from any country that you've worked in.
Sure. I'll give an example from one of the projects that we were working on in Iraq. One of the things that became very clear in Iraq, in an area, Kirkuk, which is still a very hot spot inside the country, was that the community didn't trust the police. And the police at the same time looked at the community, particularly the activists, as people who were, you know, looking to instigate problems rather than to help provide security, which is what the police saw their primary objective as. One of the things that emerged was that there were clear people in the community who wanted to have that dialogue just between the police and between the civil society activists. So we helped support them, provided them with some tools to be able to convene both the police and the civil society activists first separately so that there was an understanding of each other's role, and then bringing them together to say what the expectation from each group was, what did the police expect from the community activists, and what the community activists in return expected from the police. After a year of discussions and recommendations and dialogue, it was really clear that they were after the same goals, whereas where they started was from a point assuming that they each wanted to hinder or were obstacles to their work rather than being able to support their work. Hmm. More recently in Libya, with the formation of the National Transitional Council and the revolutionaries, again, there was a strong disconnect between the revolutionaries, you know, protect the spirit of the revolution, and what they saw as a potential for it being sidetracked by a political process. And again, we saw just naturally within Libya people stepping forward who were activists in their own right, university professors, who saw both sides and wanted to be able to convene both the youth, the revolutionaries, as well as the decision makers. Mm-hmm.
Lena, I wonder
if we help support that.
If from your experience with Search for Common Ground, you have a similar story, because it seems to me there are a lot of lessons in Binal's example there.
Yeah, and I think we have some very similar examples, but let me add two other dimensions. You know, one dimension that's really important in transforming conflict is also understanding that a perpetrator of violence today can be a protector and an advocate of peace tomorrow. And so when you believe that you can understand the reasons that push this person into abusing human rights, into committing injustice, and that one can work with them so that they can transform and become your partner in peace tomorrow, that's really important. And that's the kind of work that, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we're doing with the army and the police who are, you know, notorious for committing human rights abuses. Secondly, northern Nigeria. You've probably been hearing that every Sunday, Nigerians are suffering with these attacks by Boko Haram, right, on churches. And there's a big conflict and tension between Christians and Muslims in Nigeria right now. Yet they're not at all-out war. Why? Because organizations like ours, with many local partners, with local media, are enabling Christians and Muslims to stay in relationships. They're enabling them to come together, to remind themselves that, you know what, it's up to all of us to find a solution to this. This is not the situation we want. We talk about it on radio. We produce radio and television programs. And we bring people together so that they can see that finally it's up to us to believe in peace and not violence as a way out of this conflict.
Can I ask you, Lena, do you believe, on the bottom line question, that humanity can ever abolish war?
I think humanity can realize that war is the most ineffective way of dealing with conflict and injustice and inequality, and that when we recognize, as the congressman was saying earlier, that it's being more effective, it's reaching a higher stage of evolution and development and harmony and just in human intelligence, that if we resolve conflict by understanding each other's differences, acting on commonalities, reaching a sense of understanding of our common humanity, that that is more effective, and that as that's going to lead to the abolishing of war.
Manal, what about you? Do you think that humanity can ever abolish war?
I think that that is definitely a possibility in terms of, you know, agreeing with my colleague in terms of the ineffectiveness of war. I also think that the reality is, even when war happens, that there still needs to be immediate responses after the war in terms of conflict resolution and peace building efforts, so that it's not the only solution and they're not mutually exclusive.
So let me return with the two of you to this list of prerequisites to abolishing war that our listeners have tended to come up with, since the majority of the hundreds who posted on our site have said we can't abolish war, that global disparities between rich and poor would have to be reduced first, that democracy would need to replace domestic military rule worldwide, women would have to have half the power because testosterone fights, war won't end until it isn't so profitable. Lena, do you think that those are a meaningful core of prerequisites to ending war, or any of them in particular?
I think all of those things are part of the challenges of living as a human being in a society that is not equal, where there is injustice, where there is not full participation of all diverse voices in all of our societies. And those are challenges that we need to face. We can see them as opportunities for enabling there to be more equality, more participation, more inclusion. And those I see as the conflicts that we need to address by speaking to each other, understanding each other, and finding these solutions. So I don't see those as the problem. I see those as an opportunity to not respond with violence.
Manal, on one of those, you worked for Women for Women International in Sudan and elsewhere. How did that inform your perspective on war and gender?
I think one of the things that became very clear, I mean, particularly from my time in Iraq working with Women for Women International in Afghanistan, and it was you know, solidified through what I saw in Sudan, was that women bear the brunt of war no matter what the context. And, you know, recognizing that is that, you know, women, even now with the Arab Spring, are at the forefront of the revolutions, and yet when it comes time to the decision-making, they're completely absent and they're marginalized. And, you know, a key element, I think, which was already mentioned, is how do you make sure that women are at the table. UN Resolution 1325 and others are, you know, very important recommendations to take into consideration to ensure that women are there not only during the time of war paying the price, but at the time of peace building, because that's the only way that peace building, in my opinion, will be sustainable, is with women present.
Listeners, we will be adding your phone calls for the last 20 minutes of our end of war finale after a break that's coming up soon. You can start calling in right now if you want to say something or talk to Congressman Kucinich or John Horgan, author of The End of War, Lena or Manal or any of the other guests we have here in the green space, 212-433-WNYC. Remember, though, please be specific on how humanity can abolish war, because that is the specific question on the table today for this End of War series finale, 212-433-9692. We'll also be speaking on the phone with a few people who've posted comments by the Guardian U.S. website, which partnered with us in this project. Congressman Kucinich, do you want to react to what Manal and Lena were saying?
Well, first of all, I want to thank them for their commitment, but I do want to add a word of caution here. When we look at Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, which was also a war of choice by international powers, and then after you wreak havoc on these countries, you then go in and say, kumbaya, let's all get together. Let's work at conflict resolution. There's magical thinking there. If we create the wars, then we are not really accepting the consequences of what it is that we've done. And to go in and leave it to peacekeepers or to conflict resolution experts to try to heal that is way disconnected from what's really going on here. We have a country that has not been able to shed this imperialist instinct. And the idea that somehow we're going to dominate the world through the through surfing a global war on terror is insanity. And all the peace-building efforts in the world will fall apart in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Libya and other places, as long as we keep thinking that we can use force to try to direct policies or the distribution of resources anywhere in the world.
To what degree do you think the future potential of humanity abolishing war runs through the United States because it's the sole superpower?
Well, that's a question about the nature of power. There's power for everyone or for none. The idea that somehow we're the sole superpower, we got to reject that too. Every nation, every individual has power. And we cannot appropriate to ourselves some kind of a black hole of power that everything else gets sucked into and say everyone else is powerless. Look, no one would argue that the horrible tragedy when those planes went into the towers in this city weren't individuals expressing their sense of power. We have to be very careful about a nation which assumes that we're powerful and no one else is. And so what do you do? It's how you validate people's ability to be able to speak out on behalf of their group. And if they're trying to kill other people, that has to be challenged. I would never license violence of one group against another. But when we're talking about peace building, we have to be very careful about, on one hand, you know, carrying the arrows and throwing them, and on the other hand, we have a healing hand. No, you can't have it both ways. You can't keep creating wars and on the other hand say, oh, we're going to stop them, because every time we drop a bomb, that not only expands the war, but it has a way of rippling far into the future and comes back at us, as, you know, Chalmers Johnson and others have written.
We will continue live from the green space, the finale of our series, End of War. Brian Lehrer and WNYC, stay with us.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside. Oh, down by the riverside.
Yeah,
down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside.
Gonna study.
It's a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show in the Green Space, the finale of our series, End of War. Listeners, you can watch today's program as well as hear it. See the live streaming video on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Still with us, John Horgan, author of The End of War, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Manal Omar from the U.S. Institute of Peace, Lena Slockmulder from Search for Common Ground, and others. And as we head toward the end of the program, I just want to open the floor for anyone in our Green Space audience and anyone on the phones, if any of the veterans of war or refugees of war here in the Green Space who we heard from earlier want to react now to anything that we've been talking about, we'll give you first priority. Any other audience members, just raise your hands. And listeners, 212-433-WNYC. I do want to go to somebody who's been holding for a long time who contributed to this series online as a commenter, an Irish immigrant to the United States, Alistair Malarney, living in San Diego now, who found this on the Guardian U.S. website, which has reposted a lot of our end-of-war material. We thank them for that. Alistair, hello, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York. And what led you to answer our question, can humanity abolish war?
Well, I'm a pessimist, as you can see from my submission. I believe that war has become far too profitable and too lucrative. I don't think it's... I mean, I would love to agree with congressman's wanting to scale from personal domestic issues to world peace, but I think they are not comparable. In a domestic issue, everybody involved suffers. But in the wars that the U.S., for instance, wages, who suffers? Did Wolfowitz, Pearl, Rumsfeld, Powell, any of them suffer? No. They got very rich. At least Cheney's company got very rich off the war. I'm afraid I see no hope as long as we are brainwashed into revering the military to a state where even a reduction in the rate of increase in military spending is seen as an unpatriotic cut.
Thank you very much for chiming in. John Horgan, how about that piece in his response about revering the military? Somebody said to me along the way in this series, you know, it's not cool to be anti-troop these days, but I'm anti-troop.
Yeah, I think we have to figure out, so we just celebrated Memorial Day, and I was thinking about this this issue of how, if we're trying to envision a world without peace and the eradication of war and even the reduction of militarism as good things, then how do we talk about people who are in the military now who have served? My father and grandfather were both Navy men who both fought in World War II, so this is a personal issue for me. I'm actually not sure how to answer that question, except that I'm encouraged by the fact that so many veterans, including ones that have spoken here today, recognize from firsthand experience the horrors of war and the irrationality of war, the waste of wars, even when those wars are considered to be relatively righteous. So it is a rhetorical problem, but I would think that the soldiers themselves can help us find a way out of that by getting behind the idea of a world without war.
All right. Another caller now who saw our End of War project on the Guardian U.S. website. Michelle Balaev teaches English at Wake Forest University in North Carolina and is founder of a group called Professors for Peace. Professor Balaev, hello. Do you think humanity can ever abolish war?
Yes, I do. I do think it's possible. And I think it really starts with the people. The people have to pressure their government. And in order for that to happen, they need to know the truth. And unfortunately, we often don't hear the truth or see the truth from the media. But I don't blame the media because I think it's really, it comes back to people. We are often afraid to see the truth of war because the truth of war is that it's a horrifying, ugly mess. And we want to sleep well at night. We want to have good dreams, so we don't want to know the truth of war. So we're apathetic and we're complacent, and the media becomes complacent, and
so,
the government is complacent. So it's just a vicious cycle.
In your opinion, what could break through that cycle?
Well, I think people have to have some courage and face the truth and realize that war is really a euphemism for murder. And I don't think anyone supports murder just because you can. So we need to take local action and put a local pressure on our governments.
Thank you very much. Could I ask Syed over there, who came to the U.S. after the Bosnian War, what are you thinking in this recent part of the conversation?
Well, I think that I mentioned before, more and more people actually are aware of all those horrible things that happened in the war. And I think that we just have to continue to build based on this momentum. And I think Congressman's approach is good, but it will take a long, long time to implement all this. And I mentioned also before that I think that diplomacy and miscommunication that happened before Bosnian War was one of the reasons why that war lasted for 4 years. So more communication, and I think that we can achieve this.
Carl Callender from Black Veterans for Social Justice, what are you thinking?
I took issue when the gentleman mentioned that we shouldn't have the reverence for the troops. These are the same troops that stand ready to protect the nation at any point in time. During times of peace, the troops aren't in a hostile stance. We're in a more or less a self-defensive posture. And I think we ought to be revered, and the troops are serving are still to be revered based on the fact that they sacrificed their time, their lives, and sometimes their relationships with their family. They also come back with significant psychological casualties that they have to live with for the duration of the rest of their lives, PTSD, depression. For some of the female troops, they suffer from military sexual trauma, and they're revered because of that sacrifice and that they served. So that's what I was thinking at this point in juncture of the telegraph.
Thank you very much. Tariq from Iraq, and we get a microphone over here, and see what you've been thinking as you hear different people who've worked around the world talk about their peace-building efforts, Lena and Manal, and some of the other conversations. We can't even agree on how to bring peace. That makes it harder to bring peace. But what have you been thinking so recently arrived from Iraq?
Yeah, I'm thinking that as long as there's different kind of divisions of religions and political and rich people, there is always going to be war. This is for my opinion.
Let's go to another of our callers who saw our End of War project on the Guardian U.S. website. Peter Stevenson is a U.S. citizen living in Kunming, China, where he and his wife teach English. They did that previously in Vietnam. Peter, hello from New York. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
What led
can you hear me?
I sure can. And what led you to answer our question, can humanity abolish war?
Well, it's a question I've given a lot of thought to, and I've done a lot of reading in the past few years. So that's what drew my attention to it. What sort of started my process of learning about these kinds of issues was I happened to pick up a copy of Alexander Berkman's book, What is Anarchism?, from a great little bookstore and cafe in Baltimore called Red Emma's, named after Emma Goldman. And, I guess, first of all, the idea, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, people need to learn how to get along better, and we need conflict resolution, and our culture needs to become less violent. But I think in some ways that's kind of a straw man argument, because it's not people who start wars. People don't start wars. We know, the average person knows how to get along and resolve conflicts without murdering each other. It's politicians that start wars, period. This is something, and the way that politicians get average citizens who know how to live peacefully to join them in these wars is by telling a huge lie, basically. So
Peter, let me follow up with you on one thing. Peter, can you hear me? When you were living in Vietnam, given their experience with millions dead in the 60s and 70s, Did the people you knew there ever talk about how humanity could abolish war? Was this on their lips?
Not really. I mean, I didn't, you know, I wasn't in a position to have that kind of a conversation. That they were more concerned with reviving their economy, you know, just trying to, because Vietnam's still a very poor country,
yes,
and also trying to deal with the long lasting effects of, you know, having more bombs dropped on them than in all of World War II.
Indeed. Thank you very much for participating in this with us. We really appreciate it. Let's go back to our green space audience. There's a comment over here. Who, you've got it? Right there?
Yes. My name is Ian. And my question is, with two pro-war candidates on top of the tickets of the two major parties this fall, how can we get a message of peace, this conversation we're having today, in the political arena, and also get people to realize the economics of this discussion as well? And I want to mention that I'm very proud to be wearing my Kucinich for President t-shirt.
Well, then you can answer that question, Congressman.
It's going to be those of us who want to participate at some level in that election in 2012 to challenge the candidates who represent both political parties to define what they'll do to take America in a different direction with respect to matters of war and peace. I want to mention something that is so obvious, but it should be mentioned. You know, the UN Charter, the UN in its formative moment, was formed to end the scourge of war for all time. And if we've learned anything in the time since the UN has been formed, is really the insufficiency of the nation state to be able to deal directly with matters of conflict, the limitations of the nation state. And what I think is happening that takes us way past 2012 election is that there is an emerging awareness of a kind of a global citizenship that is above the nation state, that all over the world people are saying, stop it, just stop it. And it's starting to impact governments. And when we get enough of that in the United States, it'll impact our government.
Can I very quickly address that? Here's how optimistic I am. I actually think there is enormous potential for a courageous, imaginative political candidate to create a coalition for a national peace movement. That in a central part of a platform for the presidency. It would consist of traditional peace activists, secular believers in peace, plus people who take the commandment, thou shalt not kill, seriously. So this I think there's enormous potential among religious conservatives. I think there's great potential in the Tea Party types, people who are obsessed with government spending. Look at the enormous waste of the defense budget. It's the most obvious place where we need to cut our national budget. Feminists, veterans. I think, again, you have somebody with the eloquence of Dennis really could make this happen if they just recognize the potential. So now the idea is out there. I hope somebody takes advantage of it.
Well, I think we're going to end here. The complexity is clear. We have bitten off no small task to talk about how to abolish war. This ends our End of War series. It obviously does not end the conversation among people in the Brian Lehrer Show community, and hopefully it is just one drop in the ocean that continues to ripple out so that people don't assume that war is simply a given and actually have these conversations around New York, around America, around the world. We thank the thousands of you who have taken part through WNYC.org or The Guardian US. I want to thank our producers, Megan Ryan and Paige Cowett, for having the inspiration for this originally, and Paige for incredible follow-through. I hope we've created some food for thought and food for hope in our world that seems too often stuck in its ways. And John Horgan, because you reject the easy assumptions about humans having evolved with war in our blood from the apes, I brought you this T-shirt that someone once gave me as a thank you gift for inspiring this series. It says Primates for Peace.
I love it. That's great.
And as you see, it has some of our predecessors.
I will wear that proudly.
Primates on it. So please thank John Horgan for being a Primate for Peace. Please thank all our guests. And thanks to you all so much for coming.
Thank you so much, guys.